Hey, everybody. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Before we get to my guest, I smashed my finger with a hammer, putting a fence in. So the moral of that story is pay somebody to put a fence in. I got a Band-Aid on it. I got another piece of tape on it. I got the antibacterial ointment on it, which, by the way, expires. I don't think it needs to expire. I just think they do that so you buy more. Everything expires now. I'm going to expire. You're going to expire. All right, anyway, I'm rambling. My guest, Harris Kettleman, former CEO of 20th Century Fox, a really, really cool guy that has been at the epicenter of some of the biggest hits that have come out of Hollywood in the last 40 or 50 years. And I always like to bring people to the show who may not be household names, but have contributed to projects and things in our culture that are household names, and that's Harris. Really cool conversation. Hope you enjoy it. And please spread the word on the podcast, tell your friends about it, and go to iTunes and leave some nice comments. Always good to get those positive comments out there. All right, enjoy the interview, and don't worry about my finger. I'll be fine. I'll be fine. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us this week. I'm really excited to talk to my guest. Is someone that has had an effect on your life if you've been a living human being for the last, say, 40 or 50 years. He is the former president and CEO of 20th Century Fox Television and has a great, great track record as a television studio head, a producer, a talent agent, and responsible for such shows as MASH, Trapper John M.D., L.A. Law, The Simpsons, and Living Color, and it's Mr. Harris Kettleman. Nice to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. You have a great book out called, I love the title, You Can't Fall Off the Floor. it really chronicles this amazing career that you've had at the highest levels, and there's so much I want to talk to you about, but to start, you know, as a studio head, a producer, a talent agent, you're sort of like a five-tool player in baseball. You've kind of experienced all aspects of the business in a way. Which of those roles taught you the most valuable lessons or gave you the best work experience, would you say?
I would say it had to be Lou Wasserman, who was my first boss. He was the president of MCA. MCA, to your listeners, was the largest theatrical agency in Hollywood. It was before MCA became MCM Universal. And I was in my first year at UCLA, and I needed a job. My father was a parking lot attendant. My mom was a legal secretary. And I heard MCA was looking for office boys. And I applied, and I got the job. And I was in the mailroom. And when you're an office boy at a company like MCA, you pick up other agents' laundry. You get them coffee. You get them, you name it, you do it. And that's about after about 3 weeks of delivering mail, Wasserman's assistant said to me, "How would you like to be Mr. Wasserman's assistant?" My comment was, "Who do I have to kill to get out of the mailroom?" He said, "Well, be at his house at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning." He lived about a mile from the offices of MCA, which were in Beverly Hills. And I said, "Well, I drive an old car, you know." And she said, "No, you're going to drive his car." "Well, why am I going to his house in my car? Why does he just come to MCA?" She said, "Well, he got 6 speeding tickets driving to Palm Springs, and he had his license taken away." So I wasn't his assistant. I was his driver. And I went to his house, and I drove him to the office, and I started driving him everywhere. And after about, I'd say about 4 or 5 weeks, he said to me, "You know, I think you got a case of the smarts. Do you want to be my assistant?" And Wasserman became my master's degree. I never went back to UCLA to the regret of my mom and dad, who said you won't be anything unless you get a degree. But I learned more from Wasserman than I think I would have ever learned at a college. And he had these little tidbits. Like, he one day he said to me, "Surround yourself with the smartest people you can, because they'll make you look really smart." And he was a genius. And I was at MCA for 8 years. And when I left to go run Goods and Taubman production, Wasserman said, "In my this desk is the name of the next president of MCA, and it's you." And I said, "Lou, they'll carry you out of here in a body bag before you stop being president." And 40 years later, he stopped being president.
Wow. What was the genius of him? Like, was it his deal-making ability, his ability to spot talent, his ability to package deals? Like, where did his, what was it that sort of just taught you so much?
He had a talent. He had a talent that he could negotiate deals, which were incredible. I mean, for your listeners, in the early days of when I was at MCA, actors were on salary. Like MGM would have like 40 actors under contract. Columbia, Paramount, they'd all have actors under contract. And one day Wasserman was talking to the president of Universal, who had problems. Universal at that time had two successful movies, Mom, Pa, Kettle, and Francis Talking Mule. That was it. They couldn't afford our clients because they made too much money. And Wasserman came up with the idea for Universal that Jimmy Stewart would do a movie called Winchester 76 for no money. President of Universal, name was Bill Getz, said, well, what's the catch? There is no catch. He gets 50% of the profits of the first dollar. Now, bear in mind, no actor in Hollywood ever got a percentage of anything. And Universal agreed to it. Jimmy Stewart off of Winchester 76. Now, remember, this is quite a while ago. And ended up making over $50 million from his share of the profit. And that opened the floodgates. Then Wasserman did it for Tyrone Power. He did it for Alan Ladd. Did it for a number of his clients. So that was the genius of Lou Wasserman.
You took that sort of from his playbook a little bit, maybe when you did the deal with Stephen Bochco, a $50 million deal for 10 series with ABC, and a lot of people thought you were crazy and putting things out of whack in Hollywood, right? But it ended up being a really shrewd deal.
Well, it was. I had signed Stephen Bochco from MTM, and we did L.A. Law, and it was a big hit. And Bob Iger, who's now the president of Disney, was the president of ABC Television. And Bob and I became friends, and he said to me, we want to make a deal with Bochco to keep him here for a long time. So we're going to commit for 10 series, and the series get on the air, they work, Fox will own them, we'll have them on ABC. But I had to put up $50 million. And a meeting that I had with Rupert Murdoch, who at that time still owns News Corp, owned Fox, and Rupert looked me in the eye and he said, Harris, I buy companies for $50 million. I said, Rupert, Stephen Bochco is a company. So he said, okay, go for it. And he green-lighted it. And I made the deal. I got calls from four different studio heads. You're ruining the business. You've done this. You've done that. Well, first show that Stephen created under this deal was NYPD Blue. And NYPD Blue, up until the time when I left Fox as the CEO, had earned for Fox over $400 million. So, and then we had nine more series to do. One of them was Doogie Howser. And another one was a show called Cop Rock, which I don't want to brag about. But I got famous off of Cop Rock because everybody said, how could you do this show? I had no choice. Bochco had the autonomy to put the show in the work. And my deal was we owned it and distributed it.
Yeah.
And it lasted about 7 weeks. I think it was ahead of its time. Today, it'd probably be a big hit on Netflix.
Yeah, yeah, I think you're right. I do remember that sort of being the butt of jokes. You know, it was a musical combined. It was a sort of this hybrid musical crime drama, police drama, but you know, and you talk about that. You talk about in the book sort of putting yourself out there, and also you talk about, you mentioned Netflix and where things are right now in the business. The amount of money that's being spent on content. And I'm, from what I've sort of been able to glean, it seems like Netflix is less focused. While the content is there, the content is actually servicing the platform and the distribution platform, as opposed to the other way around, because they seem to not really do any long-term series. You know, series seems to last a series, maybe a year or two, and then it's moves on and it's over. What is that model in your mind for Netflix? Is it all about building that platform and the platform having value in the marketplace?
Well, most of the Netflix series are 10 episodes or less. Now, when I was running Fox, we had to get a minimum of 66 episodes, and then we put it in syndication, which, you know, go off network and play to your local station. And that was the model that we all followed. 10 episodes, there is no syndication. Right. You can't syndicate 10 episodes. So I don't know what the end game is. Now, when I started subscribing to Netflix, I was paying $7 a month. Now I think it's $16 a month. And they spend more money than the networks do. They can get away with more because of the content and there's no censorship. And it's a marvel to me. They're doing great shows, but eventually is the house going to collapse? I'm not smart enough to know that. They certainly are running a great operation, and I look at it with awe.
Do you think it's good for the business overall? Because you're right, they've got everybody else sort of chasing their sort of model, I guess. I mean, there's just a lot of money being spent. Do you think it's good for the business overall?
Well, that's a two-sided question. It's great for the creative community because they're making deals with the creative community that the networks can't even come close to matching. Mm-hmm. So if you're a writer, a producer, or a director, the deals are unbelievable, and they've grabbed up some really top talent. For the viewer, it's a great deal. For the investor, I'm not quite so sure.
Because it's an unknown territory, uncharted waters, and sort of they could be putting a lot of money into something that ultimately sort of goes belly up. Or
exactly right.
Has Hollywood gone in a direction or in any way that surprised you you've been at the epicenter of, you know, the some of the biggest parts of Hollywood, biggest deals in Hollywood. Like, how has, as you've seen it change over the years, are things happening where you go, man, I never thought that would happen? Or, see, I told you, I knew that would happen.
Well, I've always, from the first job I really had after I left MCA and then Goodson Tom, and I became president of MGM. And at the time I joined MGM, Kirk Corcoran is more interested in building hotels like the MGM Grand, et cetera. And we didn't have a lot of money. Even though it was MGM, they didn't have a lot of money. So my concept was, I'm not going to sign actors. In those days, every major television studio was signing actors, then building the show. I signed writers and producers because I felt content was more important to me than having just actors, because the content makes the star in television. Now, in movies, it's different. A star will open a movie, and movies are made with stars. So I always felt that was the strength. And it's interesting, that's the same philosophy that Netflix following. They're signing all the top writer producers and going on that plane, that content is more important than talent.
From your vantage point as a studio head or producer or even a talent agent, is it harder to produce a successful TV series or a successful movie?
Well, interesting you asked that. When I was at Fox, or before that at MGM, I would sit in meetings with the feature department when they'd say, we're developing this movie, because part of my job as president of television at MGM and Fox was I sold the movies to television. Now, bear in mind, the television then, you sold your movies to the three networks, which were CBS, NBC, and ABC. Fox hadn't even started. That came along later when I was as president of Fox Television, and HBO and Showtime. And I listened to those meetings, and they would say to me, well, we're doing this show with Brad Pitt, but he's not available for 2 years, so we hold the script on the shelf. Now, let's change to television. I developed a show like when I was at MGM, and we developed Chips. I developed Chips with Rick Rosner, the creator, and we started in November, and we shot the pilot in February. And I was on the air in September. So it's instant gratification.
It's so funny you should say that. I'm working with Frank Oz on a show. I'm doing an off-Broadway show, and Frank Oz is involved, and we're pitching it for TV. And he mentioned in passing, you know, Benjamin Button, the movie, he started 30 years ago. It took with Martin Short. He and Martin Short working on the idea. It took 15 years for that movie to ultimately get made. And I just, it just astounds me.
Because you know what? In movies, You got to develop it. Then you got to cast it. Then you got to get the money. In television, you come up with a concept. You go to the network. They say yes, and you make it.
Yeah, right. Exactly. What was it as a kid that drew you obviously to Hollywood? I mean, obviously, you come from a family like myself. You know, my family had nothing to do with show business. What was it that said, "Hey, I could step into this world"? That's a pretty gutsy move for a young guy to say, "Hey, I want to go for this." This is even before Lou Wasserman hired you. What was it that was attracting you to it?
I really didn't know anything about the entertainment business. And my father, bear in mind, is a working man who ran a parking lot in Los Angeles, said to me, "Get a job at Sears Roebuck. At the end of 20 years, you'll have a pension and you'll be able to retire." And I remember my saying to my dad, now bear in mind, I was 18. I said, "Dad, I don't think I'd be good selling air conditioners."
I think I could sell stars and TV shows and movies and
a lot easier than air conditioners and refrigerators.
Exactly. But you know, that was that generation.
I didn't know I wanted to be in the entertainment business. I really didn't until I took that job as an office boy. And I got to MC and I saw that. Was I starstruck? Absolutely. Yeah. I thought it was really neat to take scripts to Joan Crawford and Alan Ladd and drop them off. And they say, "Thank you much, very much, young man." And I remember Ronald Reagan, I dropped the script off. He was the only actor that did this. He said to me, "Come on in and have a Coke with me, young man." And he said, "Tell me what you want to do." The rest of them would say, "Take the script, thank you very much," and close the door. And Ronald Reagan and I became not great friends, but friends. And in my book, unfortunately, I developed a show that knocked his show off the air. But he invited me to the inauguration. And were we friends? No, we were acquaintances. Yeah, good acquaintances, but yeah, not close friends. I wasn't in his kitchen cabinet in the White House.
Right. Well, you're lucky, given the fact you knocked the show off the air, you're lucky when he became president, he didn't have you audited by the IRS, you know?
That's true.
What was it that Lou Wasserman saw in you, do you think, at that age that, you know, that said, you know, "I think you should be my assistant," and grooming you, obviously?
It's funny you asked that. I said to Lou years later when I was president of Fox, and we were sitting at lunch. I'll never forget it. We were just chatting, and he was telling me about things that were going on at Universal and how he was frustrated by certain things that were happening. And he said to me, "You know, when I hired you, I saw me in you." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. I was an usher in a theater, and I got my job working for Mr. Stein in Chicago, at Music Corporation of America, and just had a band and act." And he said, "You're a lot like me. You want to succeed." I said, "Yes, I do."
Yeah, that's great. You know, people should know, you know, you had a lot to do with a show like In Living Color. And in sort of reading up on you, you've talked about Keenan Ivory Wayans sort of wanting to really push the envelope, having outwardly gay characters, et cetera, et cetera. And in the interview that I was looking at, or the conversation that I saw, you talked about like how you were getting pushback from other areas of the studio, but you felt it was important to let these creative types really push the envelope and pull them back. Were you ever worried that someone was going to go too far or did go too far and put your job in jeopardy?
I was. But you know what? If you don't take chances, you fail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My job, you know, as I say, going back where I was really a decision maker at MGM and then Fox, you know, I could just say no all the time and I'd be right 80% of the time. But you know what? I'd lose my job because I wouldn't get anything on the air.
Right, right.
So yeah, I'll play a show that, I don't know if you remember, it's called Manimal. And Brandon Tartikoff was the president of NBC, and we were pals. We used to play baseball together on Saturdays, you know, at a pickup game. And Brandon called me, and he said, "I got this show we developed in-house. It's called Manimal. And we'd like Glenn Larson, who was one of my top producers, who created Fall Guy, and he created Magnum, P.I., and a number of big hit shows." I read the script. I said, "It's the worst script I've ever written in my life. I just forget it." Brandon, "No, no, we'll finance the whole thing." So So at the time, I was president of television. Barry Diller was president of all of Fox. And I showed the script to Barry, and he said, look, what do you got to lose? Why don't you do it? We're not going to deficit finance it. Well, it went on. Manimal is the story about a man who turns into a different animal at night. It was a makeup disaster. And we did the show, and it was on for maybe 3-4 weeks. It got canceled. All right? So now Brandon's on Saturday. Brandon Tartikoff hosting Saturday Night Live. Why? He was the president of NBC because he wanted to. And Brandon goes on Saturday Night Live. And he says, you know, I want to thank my good friend Harris Cattleman who developed Manimal for us. And I called him. I said, I won't use the profanity I use. How did you do that? He said, oh, listen, I put you on national television. Your name is known by everybody. You should be happy.
That's awesome.
One last question for you. Can you tell the listeners the Marlon Brando story where you were responsible for keeping him out of trouble? I know this is in the book, but I just think it's a great story.
Marlon Brando came out to Hollywood after doing Streetcar named Desire on Broadway. And he was the hottest young actor on Broadway, and MCA signed him. And he came out to do a movie called The Wild One, which is a movie about motorcyclists, which became a cult movie. And he had a place on, I'll never forget the street because your listeners, when I tell them why, it was on Barham Boulevard. It was a duplex, upstairs and downstairs. And my job was just to make sure Marlon stayed out of trouble. When I stay out of trouble, he didn't do drugs or any of that. He just loved beautiful women, and he was always out there. So I was babysitting him. I was a junior agent at MCA, and we were all watching football. And Marlon said, I'm going to go upstairs to run my lines. Run my lines means study his lines for the next day. And I wanted to see the end of the football game, so I'm sitting there, and the phone rang. And it was Lou Wasserman, who was my boss, who's the president of MCA. And he said, Harris, how's Marlon doing? I said, oh, he's great. He's upstairs asleep. He said, oh, really? He just walked into Chase's restaurant with three girls on his arm and not walking too straight. I run upstairs with my associate, Jay Canner, who ended up being Marlon's primary agent. And he'd taken his bed sheets, tied them together, gone out the second floor, got in his car, picked up the three girls, went to Chase's, which is the hottest restaurant in Hollywood, with the three girls. Now, my mind, bear in mind now, I'm 19. My mind is, I'm going to jump. But if I jump from the second floor, maybe I'll sprain my ankle. So I went back to face the music the next day with my bosses.
Oh, that's great. It is so great to have you on, and hope to meet you in person someday. You've got amazing success as a businessman, and what a great career. And I'm glad you didn't sell appliances at Sears Roebuck. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had some of these great shows probably. So the book is You Can't Fall Off the Floor. This is Harris Cattleman, former CEO of 20th Century Fox, among other things. Not a good babysitter, but otherwise quite a successful man. So if you need someone to babysit a star, maybe you're not the guy, but otherwise, amazing career. great to have you on.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. That was Harris Cattleman. Really, I could have talked to this guy for like 2 hours. Get his book. Really great stories in it. And appreciate you checking out the podcast. And again, tell your friends and go leave some nice comments on iTunes, and have a great week, everybody.